Hello and welcome to another episode of CISO Tradecraft, the podcast that provides you with the information, knowledge, and wisdom to be a more effective cybersecurity leader. My name is G. Mark Hardy. I'm your host for today, and we're going to be talking about Part 500, or more completely, Part 500 of Title 23 of the Official Compilation of Codes, Rules, and Regulations of the State of New York. Now, wait, before you say I'm not in New York, so I don't care, please listen. These three reasons why you should continue to pay attention. First, this regulation is titled Cybersecurity Requirements for Financial Services Companies. So if you're working in financial services, keep listening. But if not, number two, most new ideas in cybersecurity regulations start in the financial sector. It's one of the most regulated and proactive lines of business with respect to cybersecurity. And what happens here usually works its way to the rest of the world. So this is your look ahead. And if that's not enough for you, number three, it's a useful high-level framework. It's a lot shorter than something like NIST Special Pub 853 that you can use to evaluate whether or not your cybersecurity program may have significant gaps. Still listening? Well, good. I'm going to make it worth your while. Hey, quick pitch for CISO Tradecraft. If you're not following us on LinkedIn, please do so. We have a lot more than podcasts. We get information out there also on YouTube as well. You can go ahead and subscribe to that channel. And if you like what we have to say on our show, give us a call. We might be able to help you out in person with your own businesses. Contact us on LinkedIn or through our website. Okay, let's think about other industries in finance. What's the biggest controllable risk in healthcare? Patient safety. How about aviation? Passenger safety. What automobile manufacturing? Product safety. We're starting to see a trend here. As humans, we prioritize our safety above most everything else. And as a person who's both a pilot and I also fly close to 100 flights a year as a passenger, I totally agree. But if you think about it, none of these industries would exist if it weren't for a stable financial industry. Now, one of the most famous bank robbers, Willie Sutton, who happened to be the 11th person added to the FBI's 10 most wanted fugitive list, because one of the first 10 got arrested within 2 days when that list first came out. When he was asked why he robbed banks, he replied, well, because that's where the money is. And that's still true today. However, the money is mostly ones and zeros and not physical banknotes. As a result, the financial industry invests heavily in cyber, and governments pass regulations like Part 500, and industry organizations mandate best practices like the Payment Card Industry Data Security Standards, PCI-DSS, to ensure your money stay safe. Given the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, issues regulations for publicly traded companies, in some cases they'll take their lead from the financial sector. So banking regulation is a great leading indicator of what may be in the future for most companies. In March of 2017, the New York Department of Financial Services, or DFS, enacted the first instantiation of Part 500. Now, if you're wondering if you're in scope, the regulation applies to, quote, partnerships, corporations, branches, agencies, and associations operating under or required to operate under a license, registration, charter, certificate, permit, accreditation, or similar authorization under the banking law, the insurance law, or the financial services law. Well, that's a mouthful, but again, it's a government regulation. You expect something that detailed. Now, it was amended in April 2020, and it changed the annual filing dates from the 15th of February to the 15th of April. And then amended again in November 2023. And that latest amendment specifies enhanced governance requirements, additional controls to prevent initial unauthorized access to information systems, and to prevent or mitigate the spread of an attack. It adds requirements for more regular risk and vulnerability assessments, as well as more robust incident response, business continuity, and disaster recovery planning. Updated notification requirements, including a new requirement to report ransomware payments, and updated direction for companies to invest in at least annual training and cybersecurity awareness programs that anticipate social engineering attacks and that are otherwise relevant to their business model and personnel. Now, if you're familiar with other frameworks, but not this one, James and Kelly Turalla run an incredibly useful website called auditscripts.com. And one of the resources they offer is a critical security controls master mapping, which is a crosswalk among nearly 40 different security frameworks. Yeah, there are not many of them, which includes Part 500. And we've got a link to that in the show notes so you can access them. That way, if you're already familiar with a security framework, which you should be, but this is new to you, you can figure out how this thing works together. Now, Part 500 defines a number of terms with which you should be familiar in this context, but let's review a couple just to see how they might apply in this environment. A cybersecurity event means any act or attempt, successful or unsuccessful, to gain unauthorized access to, disrupt, or misuse an information system or information stored on such information system. That's an event. Compare that to a cybersecurity incident, which means a cybersecurity event that has occurred at the covered entity, its affiliates, or a third-party service provider that, one, impacts the covered entity or requires the covered entity to notify any government body, self-regulatory agency, or any other supervisory body. Come back to that in a minute. Two, has a reasonable likelihood of materially, whatever that means, harming any material part of the normal operations of the covered entity, or three, results in the deployment of ransomware within a material part of the covered entity's information systems. Now, note the important difference between an event and an incident. You likely have thousands, if not millions, of cybersecurity events every day. Go scan your failed login attempt. You may see countries that you can't even pronounce. The constant scanning and probing by actors anywhere in the world may generate an event. Although those are not reportable, you'd be doing nothing else than reporting all day long. But your goal is to make all of these events unsuccessful in becoming an incident. Now, the original version of the regulation did not define the term incident. It just stated you had to have an incident response plan. According to this new definition, if I have to notify any government agency of an incident, I also need to notify the state of New York. Now, this is important because other regulations might have notification thresholds that are much lower than what you might encounter here. For example, even the loss of a single record containing sensitive data. Now, the lawyers in New York have written a rather comprehensive catch-all clause here that means you need to be adding New York DFS to your Christmas card list or any time you need to file a breach report anywhere else. Now, what is covered with respect to IT versus something else? That is, were Willie Sutton to return and make off with a bag full of cash, it would not be reportable here, but if he hacked into the bank, it would be. The definition of information systems are a discrete set of electronic information resources organized for the collection, processing, maintenance, use, sharing, dissemination, or disposition of electronic information, as well as a specialized system such as the industrial process controls of systems. Now, I realize I'm going into definitions and reading them verbatim, and you might think this is a little bit boring, but I want to get into some of the nuance here, so bear with me. In this case, it's a rather broad definition. It says a discrete set. Now, what do we mean by a discrete set? Is SharePoint your system? Is that a discrete set? How about every site? How about each folder? How about a file in the folder? Which represents discrete set? It's kind of hard to tell. Now we're going to go back and revisit this term a little bit when we discuss vulnerability management requirements. But understand that some of these definitions are fairly high level and some interpretation is left to the regulator. Maybe to you, but at the end of the day, regulator wins. Multi-factor authentication is defined. And this is important. Pay attention here. It means authentication through verification of at least two of the following types of authentication factors. One, knowledge factors, such as a password. All right, something you know. Two, possession factors, such as a token, something you have. Three, inheritance factors, such as a biometric characteristic. Multi-factor authentication shall be utilized for any individual accessing any information systems of a covered entity. Well, what's missing here? Well, first of all, a fourth authentication factor is where you are, either through GPS or locating you from a known IP address. But if you want to remove friction and establish a conditional access policy that exempts your user from having to enter a second factor when they're at their desk, on a corporate device, in a physically protected office, at a known IP address, you're now violating the regulation as it's written. If you use an email address or a phone number as a second factor, that may be debatable whether or not that is a possession factor. Now, just in case you're thinking these regulators are out of touch with business reality, there is a workaround, and it states, quote, if the covered entity has a CISO, the CISO may approve in writing the use of reasonably equivalent or more secure compensating controls, and such controls shall be reviewed periodically but at a minimum annually. Now, in my humble opinion as a CISO, I would approve in writing this use case of using a person, a corporate device, and a locked corporate office which has physical access controls from a known IP address to reduce the friction of being able to have to provide MFA 10, 20 times a day. But I have to do it in writing. Now, also note as a side note that the NYDFS puts out an industry letter. And it industry letter in December 2021 contained guidance on MFA. And it notes that, quote, lack of effective MFA has been the most frequently exploited cybersecurity gap in the cybersecurity events reported to the department. And declares that, quote, not all forms of MFA are equal. It notes that push-based MFA is more susceptible to human error than token-based MFA. And what's most revealing is their statement that says, in every case where cyber criminals escalated privileges during a reported cybersecurity event, the privileged account lacked MFA. Wow. It can't seem to underestimate the importance of multi-factor authentication here. If you don't have MFA on every single administrator account, stop this recording right now. Go fix it and then come back. And if you do have MFA, consider carefully whether the vulnerability to something like SIM swapping of an SMS-based MFA is a risk that you are willing to accept in writing, because DFS guidance warns of this, doesn't outright prohibit it, but you don't want to be the test case. If NYDFS will punish companies for having their SMS-based MFA compromised through a SIM swap, and you just happen to be the first in line. Bottom line, multi-factor authentication has really been very effective. Why? Because we started out with attacks that would go after technical controls. People would find gaps, they'd find hacks, they'd find weaknesses, they'd find bugs and vulnerabilities. And as a result, they'd break in that way. Those of us who took pen testing courses 10 years ago, we would focus on all the ways we could go ahead and get into things. Today, we've upped our game quite a bit. So where does the attacker go? Go after the human. And they each can go ahead, if I can get a credential, I'm in. If I get your ID and password, I'm in. If I can shoulder surf, I'm in. If I can divert you to a lookalike website and get you down on your credits there, I'm in. And so MFA now requires two things. And if we can look at different levels, and I have MFA fails just a couple episodes ago, go back and look it up on CISO Tradecraft, where I talked about the different scenarios where it can and can't work. And probably the most secure way to do MFA is with a physical token. I'm experimenting right now with my own YubiKeys, trying to make that part of my routine as a CISO so that I get it. And then be careful, though. I noticed that they have a Yubi Nano, which looks like the little tiny plug you could stick in there for a wireless mouse. Well, what happens if you put one of those? You're going to leave it in there. And now all of a sudden, your laptop is a bearer instrument for an attacker. If they can get your laptop, they get your MFA. So think carefully through how you want to do MFA. Okay, enough on that. The last term with regard to this regulation is non-public information, at least from a definition. And here it's not limited to what we would consider customer PII, because it does include that. But it also includes business-related information of a covered entity, the tampering with which or unauthorized disclosure, access, or use of which would cause a material adverse impact to the business, operations, or security of the covered entity. Now, if your company loses documents that forecast your quarterly financial statements, someone might use those to go ahead and get on the stock market and start buying or selling and make profitable trades on this insider information. That could be considered a material impact. Now, remember, the standard, like many others, doesn't define material. And I most strongly recommend that you don't try to do so either. Consult with your chief financial officer and your chief counsel and get their definition of materiality in writing. For example, they might decide that materiality is some dollar amount or a percentage of total revenue. Whatever it is, deciding what is or is not material is above your pay grade, as we like to say in the military. So get the right people engaged early to lock down this definition so it's there when you need it. Now, what does DFS require that we have not seen? First, we need a minimum number of written policies and procedures. Policies such as an information security policy, check. Data governance, okay. Asset inventory, have I got one of those? Policy in writing. Security awareness training, I know we have required training, but is there a policy in your company? And numerous other documents. There's at least 15 different written policies are called out by the name in this regulation. So be sure that you have all of them. The regulation states that each covered entity shall designate a CISO. Hooray, we finally earned a place at the grown-ups table of executives. Then it goes on to say, this is a quote, the CISO of each covered entity shall report in writing at least annually to the senior governing body on the covered entity cybersecurity program, including to the extent applicable, one, the confidentiality of non-public information and the integrity and security of the covered entity's information systems. Two, the covered entity's cybersecurity policies and procedures. Three, material cybersecurity risks to the covered entity. Four, overall effectiveness of the covered entity's cybersecurity program. Five, material cybersecurity events involving the covered entity during the time period addressed by the report. And six, plans for remediating material inadequacies. Quick, pick those things apart. Number one, talking about in a written report that you give to the senior members, your confidentiality of non-public information, how do you protect it? How about the integrity of your information systems? How do you protect that? How about our policies and procedures? Are they complete? Are they up to date? Have they been reviewed and signed? Have you had any material cybersecurity risks in the past year? Say we're using 1 year reporting period. And that materiality, as I said, has to be defined in advance before you can decide what it is. How about the overall effectiveness of your cybersecurity program? Come back to that one. Material cybersecurity events involving the covered entity and plans for remediating these material inadequacies. And additionally, the senior governing body of the covered entity shall exercise oversight of the entity's cybersecurity risk management program, which means everything doesn't just land on top of the CISO. The board is responsible for having sufficient understanding of cybersecurity-related matters such as oversight. Now, note a little side note, when the SEC came out with the regulations last year on cybersecurity requirements, there is one proposal that didn't make it into the final regs requiring cybersecurity knowledge to be on a board. Because I thought if that were in there, I might find myself on a few boards. There is a requirement for financial knowledge. You can't have a board that doesn't understand numbers. But apparently right now, although boards have some responsibilities, under the SEC rules, there's not a requirement to have somebody as an expert. But here, the board is responsible for having sufficient understanding of cybersecurity-related matters, such as oversight. In my opinion, the best way to do that is get a knowledgeable senior person on there who gets cybersecurity, understands the business, and put them up there on the board. Another one is requiring the executive management team or its designees to implement and maintain a cyber program. And this means that while the board has governance and oversight, the tactical work is probably done by the CISO. At least it's a requirement that you have to have a cyber program. Regularly receiving and reviewing management reports about cybersecurity matters. Well, guess what? Now as a CISO, you don't have to fight for the right to brief the board. There's a regulation that requires CISOs to come up and present the cyber reports. Now, regularly is not defined, but I would suspect at a minimum annually because of all the other reporting requirements that exist. How about this one? Confirming that the covered entity's management has sufficient resources to implement and maintain an effective cybersecurity program. This one's novel. Do you think that the cyber program is underfunded? Do you think that you don't have enough resources? Try this. Have a cyber program maturity assessment performed by an independent audit team. Go to the board and show that the results, which say you're missing key people, processes, or have technology gaps, and then tell the board you don't have sufficient resources to implement and maintain the cybersecurity program to provide an effective protection. If you list this as a key risk, it's now shifting the accountability to the board for ensuring the cyber objectives can be met. Usually, the best time to get money out of a board is right after an incident. But there's a half-life of awareness of incidents. That is to say, when something hits the fan and everybody says, oh, we need to fix the cyber thing, wallets open up, money and resources become available, but not forever. The half-life of awareness of a cybersecurity event, senior management, my opinion is about 30 days. If you wait a month and then you go ahead and make an ask, half the time they've moved on to some other risk. There's something going on with the bridge being blocked and you can't get your traffic in and out, or there's an issue with getting things in and out of a foreign nation in China, or there's something else taking place with a labor relations problem, or. And then 30 more days, another 50% go away. And so what you have to be able to do is be locked and loaded with your requests and requirements. Don't go to the board, brief a whole bunch of deficiencies, And they say, oh my goodness, we need to fix that. What do you want to do? It's like, where's your plan? It's like, well, I didn't write one. I didn't think I'd get you to say yes. Have the plan with you. Have it in your back pocket. Pull it out and say, please press hard. You're making three copies. Sign right there. NYDFS cybersecurity program also discusses the vulnerability management topic, and it's pretty vague. I mean, for example, clear guidance is given to be informed of new security vulnerabilities and have a monitoring process in place, but it doesn't give any timelines for remediation. Only says timely remediate vulnerabilities. Is that 3 days, 30 days, 300 days? They get to make that determination unilaterally. Now, DFS does require organizations to perform pen testing of their information systems at least annually. Now, this is where you consulting your legal team is key. Let's say your organization hosts 5,000 applications. Do you need to perform 5,000 pen tests each year? Probably not. But if you have a risk assessment that says only these certain applications are considered in scope for processing PII or could cause a material impact, those are the two requirements that you have to worry about, then you can likely decrease that number to a much more acceptable and manageable level. You can also be a bit creative to say, we just performed a pen test last year on this very risky application. Our risk assessment says the chance of us finding new vulnerabilities and another penetration test is low, so we're going to go ahead and skip it for this year. Of course, that's a little risky you have to be willing to take, but sign off on it. Overall, we encourage CISOs to work with your legal teams to document what applications are in scope so you can make these types of decisions and document them for any potential audits or challenges that might come up from future audits. Section 6 identifies the need for an audit trail. It means your organization needs the ability to reconstruct material financial transactions, and your audit trail should also be designed to detect and respond to cybersecurity events that have a reasonably likelihood of materially harming, there's that word again, any part of normal operations. Now, the requirement for cybersecurity audit record retention is 3 years. Do your SaaS solutions provide that? I believe the default for Microsoft is 30 days. And if you do not have a data lake or other repository for long-term storage of logs or don't have a tool to get that, get out your digital divining rod, find some way to create that data lake, and start collecting so you can meet this requirement. Section 7 covers access privilege and management. It's another one that's quite interesting. Every organization typically gets an auditor request to show a list of everyone who's changed jobs over the last 2 years and show a list of those users' privileges and entitlements that they have access to right now. Let's check to see if any of those users still have and maintain entitlements that aren't necessary for their new role. And if some employees still have accesses to resources and SharePoint sites and things from their former teams and former assignments, you now have an audit finding. One of the things that I have found out is that some organizations will do this. In the financial world, there are some times where everybody has to take your 2 weeks vacation. It's not optional. You can't be a worker. Yeah, if you're a workaholic, fine, but you got to be out of the building, et cetera. Why? Why do they do that? Because if you got some scam going on or something like that, there's a chance to potentially find it while you're out. So some places absolutely require you be 2 weeks in a row out of the building, can't come in. Got it. Okay, fine. Well, what they do is when you come back from that, instead of just sitting back at your desk and going, okay, fine, here I am, blow the dust out of my coffee pot, you zero base all your privileges. You got to go sit down with IT and get them all turned back on again. And that way you avoid the problem of things accruing and becoming greater than they should be. That's just one particular thing to think about, but it does require coordination with HR and things like that. Now, when we look at these things and we talk about people accumulating rights and rules and things, if that repeats across multiple audits, now you've got a systemic issue. And the standard calls out those requirements by saying you must limit user access privileges to information systems that provide access to non-public information to only those necessary to perform the user's job. And this one's probably going to be the most violated rule in the standard. We can easily see a company that grants someone access to a tool such as Salesforce. They have permission to see more accounts than they should. They're not actually working with every last one. For example, a help desk person covering only one sales region can really look up customers from all regions, unless you really have some permissions with sufficient granularity. But if you've ever looked at Salesforce permissions, it's huge. I can't get my head around it. It's just massive. But what if that help desk person is phished and exports the entire customer record database from Salesforce and it all gets stolen? Now, here we expect every major breach to have some violation of this rule when the DFS starts poking around. Now, the access privilege and management section also requires a privileged access management or PAM solution and the ability to block all commonly used passwords. While this may have been used to meet other cyber regulations, this may be the first regulation to require a PAM solution to be in place. So make sure you have something like a CyberArk or BeyondTrust in your organization that you can cite as evidence that you fulfill this requirement. Moving on, the standard has very minimal guidance on application security. You won't see any requirements for having tools like SAST or DAST or container scanning or cloud security posture management. You just need to include written procedures, guidelines, and standards to ensure the use of secure development practices. Now, there's a little bit light for regulation these days. Interpretation is that if I have a policy that says the developer is responsible for creating code that minimizes vulnerability and shall have it peer reviewed to identify defects, then I actually don't need to run a security tool, right? Because it doesn't say I have to have any of these tools. Seems a little bit weak to us here at CISO Tradecraft, but hey, we didn't write the standard, but just be aware of the fact that I would not rely on the lack of specificity as a defense when there are best practices in the industry that are out there you could and should be using. The ninth section focuses on risk assessment, and your organizations must perform them annually. Be sure to look at what you call a risk assessment. Is it a third-party risk assessment? Is it an architecture review? Is it threat modeling? Should you define what it is for your organization and make sure the process for applications that are in scope for DFS are performed every 12 months. Another section highlights that cyber personnel need to be qualified and trained. Be sure members of your team have at least one certification that requires continuing professional education credits. For example, having a CISSP that requires annual CPE credits is something that checks the box here on this requirement. The 11th section focuses on third-party service provider security policy. And this one's a bit descriptive. Here you need to ensure that your third parties have important cybersecurity policies and procedures, MFA, encryption, as well as, quote, representations and warranties addressing the third-party service provider cybersecurity policies and procedures that relate to the security of the covered entity's information systems or non-public information. So if you've ever had to do reps and certs and things such as that, or get a questionnaire from some company that says, please fill out these 432 questions about your cyber because you're a subcontractor, this is where it's coming. Now, notice cyber usually doesn't utilize these representations and warranties in other places, so pay attention to this one. Section 12 discusses multi-factor authentication, and it states that it shall be utilized for any individual accessing any information systems of a covered entity. Now, CISOs will need to get a list of all applications in scope for NYDFS, and then declare every one of those applications will require MFA. Now, note that the implementation deadline for this requirement is November of 2025, 18 months after some of the effective dates, 24 months. So some of these things are different if you take a look at the regulations, and there's a link in the notes to the schedule of what has to go where. But the big list is there. The big thing to remember is be sure your list is comprehensive and exhaustive. For example, you might easily think about what applications are used by customers. However, what about logs of those applications, backups of those applications, monitoring tools such as your SIM? They have copies of your data and they get breached, they probably also lose customer PII. Now, are each of them scoped for DFS? Do they have MFA as well? Did you do a risk assessment on those or a pen test? See, all these things are starting to integrate. Section 13 states that each covered entity shall implement written policies and procedures designed to produce and maintain a complete, accurate, and documented asset inventory of the covered entity's information systems. And this includes designating for each the owner, the location, the classification or sensitivity of data, the support expiration, recovery time objectives, and the frequency required to update and validate the asset inventory. It's a lot. Additionally, organizations must maintain the asset inventory in accordance with written policies and procedures. See, as a CISO, you now have a regulation forcing you to buy a CMDB or an asset inventory type tool to meet this requirement. Section 14 identifies monitoring and training requirements. And here you see companies required to prove an endpoint detection and response solution, as well as a solution which centralizes logging and security event alerting. You might think of this as an EDR and a SIM. However, SIM isn't explicitly spelled out, so it could be an XDR or another solution like PagerDuty that generates alerts from logs and inputs that are fed to it. On the training side, organizations need to implement risk-based policies and monitor the activity of authorized users and detect unauthorized access. This might be as simple as watching your single sign-on logs or logs that control access to see who's routinely trying to open shared folders which they're not granted access. And finally, we also see the requirement for annual cybersecurity awareness training that includes social engineering. Now, here, cyber departments have a requirement to create a mandatory cyber training class or go out and buy it from another company. It's a nice addition. Honestly, it's good to see a focus beyond technology to include people. And certainly, social engineering attacks and phishing attacks are not going to go away anytime soon. There's even a section on encryption. It's pretty high level. It requires a written policy for encrypting information in transit and at rest. And if in some cases it's infeasible, then the CISO needs to approve effective alternative compensating controls and review them annually. It's no longer good enough to just stick something on a risk register and forget about it. It needs to be an annual review process to say, hey, yeah, we're still okay with these risks. Now, the last section in there worth mentioning is one of the longest. It's one on incident response and business continuity management. It's not too complicated, and there's no real surprises in there. You do need written plans and policies that contain proactive measures on how your organization investigates, mitigates, and responds to cyber events. It requires you to have an incident response plan, a business continuity plan, and a disaster recovery plan. More importantly, you need to test these plans annually and ensure your company has the ability to restore its critical data and information systems from backups. When's the last time you actually did that? Yeah, we got backups. Yeah, do they work? Yeah, of course. Did you restore? Yeah, we did. No. Did you restore and then become operational from a restored copy? Well, that's kind of busy. We're getting that. No. Want to test that. You've heard some of the stories I've told in previous episodes of things like Dataport, where all the data got deleted on its way to the backup site. And it was out of scope for both parties. It was a courier who had accidentally damaged everything. So you want to test these backups. And make sure your backups are ransomware proof. That is to say, you want to create read-only backups that a bad actor can't overwrite. And once you get all these steps in place, don't forget to start collecting the evidence, the proof, the validation that you're doing all these things. Because this will help in the event there's an audit or there's a question on any of the attestations that you're making. Well, I hope you enjoyed learning about the New York Department of Financial Services Cybersecurity Regulation, Part 500. There's a lot to unpack, but generally, I give it a thumbs up for making the banking sector even more secure. And if you enjoyed today's podcast, do us a favor and give us a thumbs up. Maybe a five-star review on the podcast channel you're listening to, or subscribe on YouTube if you could, because once their numbers are up above a certain point, they stop throwing ads in your face. And we would like that. And I think you'd like that too. And let other people know where you're getting information to help you with your personal journey in your cybersecurity tradecraft in your career, because we'd love to be able to help more. This is your host, G. Mark Hardy. Thank you very much for tuning in and for paying attention. If you got any questions, contact us at CISO Tradecraft. Otherwise, until next time, stay safe.